We say unprecedented a lot these days, but there's never been a US presidential contest like this one in post-war history. With 1 month to go, we ask, could American democracy survive the re-election of Donald Trump?
This election is the most important in the modern history of this country.
You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay?
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
No matter what the president says, this country belongs to you.
Why doesn't President Trump condemn racism? His own words and actions tell you why. He's a racist.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Today, we're joined by Cass Muda, Professor of International Affairs at the University of Georgia. He is one of the world's leading experts on populism and the far right. In this US presidential election like no other, we ask him about his expectations and the dangers ahead. In part two, we'll turn from the United States to Europe, asking how we can confront the rise of the radical right here. As usual, you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible, the campaign group that acts as the home and the hub of the European left in Britain. By joining us, you participate in our movement-building efforts to confront injustice, oppose nationalist disaster capitalism, and promote grassroots internationalism. To join, support our work, and gain access to an extended version of this podcast, go to anothereurope.org/join.
Hi, Kaz, welcome to the show. We were about 1 month to go in the US presidential election, and something incredible happens, which is the man who didn't believe in COVID has now tested positive for COVID. Do you see any kind of risk here, not in terms of his health especially, but in terms of constitutional risk to the election itself?
Well, there are so many possibilities, from him dying to him miraculously surviving. I don't necessarily see any particular risk constitutionally, although in the highly unlikely event that he would die, you would have, of course, a candidate on the ballot that is no longer there. And that would at least give a lot of confusion. But I think more than anything, assuming that Trump lives, this will probably fuel conspiracy theories, particularly on the right. And if he loses, this is yet another point where people can argue that that is the reason why he lost.
Right, because I mean, I've seen conspiracy theories already on the left, actually, that he doesn't really have the virus and he's just using it to his own ends to kind of get a sympathy bounce. Do you think that conspiracy theories are so rife now on both sides that it's really hard for either to pick a path through it?
Yeah, and also, of course, you have conspiracy theories and you just have healthy skepsis. I mean, the US government, not only under Trump, but under Bush too, but definitely under the Trump administration, they have lied about so many different things that you're crazy if you believe everything at face value that comes out of there. Now, I don't necessarily say that he has made up that he tested positive for COVID, but he's not the same as every other president. And so you should think about these things. Obviously, he's going to try to stay out of hospital and try to make this work for him. And if he actually tests for COVID and then in the end won't get very sick, then obviously he's going to say, look, this is just proof that it's just a little flu and we're being crazy about this. Now, do we know whether he actually had it? I don't think we'll ever know. Do we have to come up with all kinds of conspiracy theories about it? No, I don't think that's particularly helpful either. But we also shouldn't treat this administration as if it is, let's say, a classic democratic government. Like, I'm from the Netherlands and we trust our government in general and perhaps even a little bit too much. But I think there's value in that. But there's also value in being skeptical, particularly if you've been lied to over and over again.
Well, that brings us quite neatly to what should have been our first question, which is that everyone knew that his presidency would be like no other. after that uber-racist campaign and the bellicose language with which he was inaugurated. But it seems even worse than we imagined. Is it right to say that American democracy is now in danger like never before?
No, not like ever before, of course, because there was a civil war. But it's bad. It's bad, particularly the last couple of months. I'm not so sure whether he was worse than we imagined. It depends a lot on who imagined. I mean, there were people talking about fascism and everything. And I mean, let's face it, definitely hasn't been fascism over the last 4 years. I still believe that, leaving aside all of the symbolism and the rhetoric on Twitter, like, I don't see too many fundamental changes between what Donald Trump has done and what Republicans before him have done. It is a matter of degree. It's a quantitative difference rather than a qualitative difference. A lot of the things that we're reading about now, about voter suppression and other things, have been going on for technically centuries. That's not to say that he's just another Republican, but he is very much a Republican on steroids. And so we were going this way. Like, we were going this way, but now we're going even faster. And now we have pretty much a lot of doubt about everyone. But let's not forget that Trump could never have done this by himself. And the reason why we worry about US democracy, and we should, is because the Republican Party as a whole is not willing to stand up against him, and to a large extent is helping him.
Now, you said that after the recent Republican convention that was quite extraordinary, really, in the sense that the Republican convention became something like the Trump family roadshow. I mean, I know American politics loves its dynasties, but it was completely dominated by Trump and his close coterie around him. And maybe we shouldn't, you know, debate whether the F word, whether this is fascist or something. You know, certainly the language that Trump uses is a kind of fascist speak, even if the regime that he runs in the United States isn't a fascist regime. Would you accept that, or would you push back on that reading of the Republican convention and his politics more broadly?
Yeah, I'm pretty rigid in my terminology, and I just don't accept fascism as just a generic term for right-wing anti-democratic regimes. Like, there are many different forms of anti-democratic right-wing regimes. We've seen them in Latin America. We've seen them in Southern Europe. For me, fascism is a specific system, which isn't necessarily limited to the 1930s, 40s, but it has a very strong ideology. It has a very clear idea about how society should be structured. It believes in violence as a cleansing mechanism, all those kind of things. And while he flirts with aspects of that, I just don't think that Trump has a coherent ideology. And as a consequence, I don't like the term to be used. I also think it's unnecessary. Like, I mean, there are more than enough things really threatening to a democracy that are not called fascism. And there is no doubt that Trump has very strong anti-democratic impulses. He has made his whole career within a structure that is deeply authoritarian. He doesn't have the patience for compromise. He by and large doesn't accept anyone as an equal. Right. But for me, that's not so much fascism. That's an instinct. But it is, in the end, in the core, as threatening to the US democratic system as fascism would be.
I mean, if we're to take on that threat to the US democratic system, maybe we could discuss some of the constitutional issues. There's been talk, which I think a lot of Brits don't get at all, that in the event of a contested election, the Republicans claiming mail-in votes are fraudulent, for example, that the Republican-controlled states in the Electoral College may take the unprecedented step of not casting their ballots in line with the election results in that state. Now, as I say, a lot of us, including me, just don't get that and don't get how that could be possible. Can you explain that?
That's a little bit hard. And to be honest, this is one of the things that seems to be going around. I haven't heard about it myself, but the US is fundamentally not a democracy because people don't vote for their leaders. And so while it seems as if the US has a popular election of the president, they actually don't, because they vote people for the Electoral College, who then vote for the presidential candidate. Now, the understanding is that these electors, these people who are elected to the Electoral College, do not have an individual vote, but pretty much follow the rules of the state. And all but two states have kind of a first-past-the-post system. So if you win the state, then all the electors from the state will vote for that winner. Only Nebraska and Maine have a more proportional system. Now, I just Googled this, but only some 160 electors have ever in the history of the US not voted for the person they were supposed to vote for. And if you take that into account, then if Republican electors in Republican-controlled states that would vote for the Democrats in this election, would vote for Biden in this election, would actually ignore those rules and not vote for Biden as they're supposed to do, but vote for Trump, that would be unprecedented. Now, in most states, this is not legal, but in most states, it's also not enforceable, and at worst, you get a fine. So you have this weird situation that the whole system is built on this kind of small step in between the popular vote and the actual vote, where you have this small group of people that virtually no one knows, that technically have the power to do whatever they want to, even though they're not supposed to. But we, of course, what we have learned over the last 4 years, that norms mean very little for the current administration, as well as for the current Republican Party.
The death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has led Trump to nominate Amy Barrett, as we've heard from the news. She's a hardline conservative. Her membership of the Pentecostal organization People of Praise has been in the spotlight because it has this crazy Handmaid's Tale-like view of the world and even has an all-male leadership. In fact, I believe the highest office a woman can even hold in the organization is that of woman leader, and this position was formerly called Handmaid by the group. So it's really quite shocking through the looking glass stuff. And if the election is contested, as seems likely, you know, isn't it right that the Supreme Court will play a key role in things? I wonder also, is there a potential impact of Trump becoming ill with his ability to drive through this Supreme Court nomination prior to the presidential election as the Republicans are currently planning to?
Yeah, and again, I think that this reflects a problematic view where we think that you have this responsible Republican Party, which is kind of hijacked by this evil Donald Trump. Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and now Barrett are all nominees for the Supreme Court, which come from a list by the Federalist Society, a very conservative group, which would have been followed by any Republican president. Ted Cruz would have done it, but also others. So this is not something that just Trump wants to do. I would argue actually that it's more important for various Republicans in Congress who need kind of the support of particularly the evangelical movement, the so-called religious right, to win their election, whereas the religious right loves Trump and would come out for him anyway. So in this sense, this is as much about Mitch McConnell as this is about Trump. Now, the question is, what role is the Supreme Court going to play? That is really difficult to say. It is very likely that there will be challenges to the outcomes of elections in certain states. However, remember that you can only really challenge the outcome if they are relatively close and you can argue that whatever you say has happened, voter fraud or voter suppression, potentially will have impacted the outcome. Now, sure, we have more than enough swing states where that would be the case, but then this would only happen if who's in power in the state loses. That then goes first, in most cases, to the state court. And only then it could potentially go for final judgment to the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court takes it. everything can go terribly wrong. And so I don't want to minimize this. And I live in this country and I'm very worried about that. But it's also not the case that the Supreme Court, even when run by conservatives, has just rubber stamped everything that the president wanted. It has a lot to do with the legalities. And so if the case doesn't have a strong legal foundation, I don't think even a 6-3 court is going to overturn something just because Trump wants it. At the same time, if the case looks decent enough to favor your president, then they probably have. And of course, in the past, this has done. And so I think what this all says is that for Biden to be a comfortable winner, he needs a landslide, not just winning enormous amount of states, but also winning many of them very clearly.
Just to stay on the Supreme Court for a second, the other thing many campaigners are worried about is abortion in relation to the Supreme Court, that this will effectively turn into a referendum on abortion, because that will be the first move is against Roe versus Wade. Is that a serious concern at this point?
Yeah, but it always was. Like, I watched a Netflix documentary about Roe v. Wade last year or something, and it made it very clear that the next 4 years are going to be decisive whether Roe v. Wade is still important. There have been so many court cases, and even at the moment, there are so many court cases awaiting Supreme Court judgments that come through particularly conservative states here in the South. And they were already getting close to that. And this was what pretty much Trump has fought his election in 2016 on already, and 2020 again. Like, one of the reasons why the religious right not only love him, but come out in massive numbers, is he gave them two anti-abortion Supreme Court judges, and he's going to give them a third one. Again, any other Republican had done the same under the current circumstances. But to a certain extent, this is not even particularly good for Trump, because for Trump, it would be better if this was still to be fought for, right? Because if he appoints Barrett to the Supreme Court, then pretty much people will come to vote to reward him for that, rather than if RBG would have still been alive, he could have argued, look, she's going to die in the coming 4 years. You have to vote for me to make this sure. At the moment, once Amy Barrett is confirmed, pretty much Trump isn't needed for overturning Roe v. Wade anymore, because the court is 6-3 for quite a while to come.
And as you plugged the Netflix documentary on Roe versus Wade, could I also encourage listeners, I don't know if you've seen it, to watch the brilliant drama show Mrs. America that follows from the 1970s, the conservative, ultra-conservative in some ways, movement against the Equal Rights Amendment that sprung up in that time, and really draws a link between the Reagan era conservatism and the Trump era through the lens of following Phyllis Schlafly, who was a big opponent of the Equal Rights Amendment. I think you've covered this a little bit already, but if we could stay on the theme, because it's something you've been saying for a while and is already come through in your comments here, that the Republican Party is the problem. The Republican Party has increasingly moved to become this kind of increasingly populist radical right outfit, perhaps a far right party, if we use that term. What implications does that have for the future? Because I think about this all the time, and you look at Trump and you say, even if Trump is defeated this time, for the 20, 30, 40 years ahead, one of the major parties in American politics that will be in power at some point again in the future has really lurched to the right. And, you know, presumably you share those concerns, and perhaps we could talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I've argued that the Republican Party is a radical right party for several years. And in part, this is based on pretty much two things. On the one hand, if you look at who the last three standing leaders in the primaries were of 2015-16, it was Ted Cruz, who clearly is far right, even though it's more religious than nativist. It was Donald Trump, of course, who I think is overly, like, clearly a far right leader. And it was Marco Rubio, who, like, we now consider a moderate, but who actually got elected on the Tea Party ticket. And if you look at the base, the Republican base, then we already know this from the period of the Tea Party, that actually the difference between the Tea Party voter and the average Republican voter wasn't that big. And if you looked at the key points of the Trump campaign, then actually already before Trump became the nominee, the Republican Party was much more the party of Donald Trump than it was of Mitch McConnell. And I think that this was always forgotten or missed because people in the United States and abroad always look at Congress. And particularly if there isn't a Republican president, you look at Congress to see what the party is. But that's a very small part of the party. And I live in the South, in the Southeast, which of course is a very specific history and particularly racist history and also authoritarian. But it's also in many ways the heartland of the Republican Party. And actually in many ways, it is the South that dominates the Republican Party at the moment. And there's a remarkable number of Southerners in the Trump administration as well. So while Trump is much more open about these things than previous leaders, there was always a very strong far-right aspect to the party, particularly at the state level, let alone at the local level. Now, what does that all mean? Of course, this is a big tent party, as the Democratic Party is very diverse. It's even more diverse than the Conservative Party in Britain is. The Republicans overall in, for example, California or in New York are not as conservative on average as those in the South. But I think what is crucial about the current election is the future of the party. If Trump wins, we will see a transformation of the party at all levels, because in the last 4 years, he hasn't really brought in too many people. There isn't a Trumpian base, but it is growing. Like you have groups like Students for Trump, Turning Point USA, which are new kind of what they call conservative groups that work outside of the Republican Party and the young Republicans and try to take them over. Now they're still young, but in 4 years, they will be more and more visible in the party. That said, if Trump loses massively, there undoubtedly is going to be a backlash. And structurally, the Republican Party can't win on a white supremacy agenda because the US is becoming a majority minority country. And there is a strong push, particularly in the Southwest, for the party to become more embracing towards conservative Hispanics. And so to me, this election is not just an election about the soul or even the democracy of the United States. It's also about the future of the Republican Party. If Trump wins, the party is going to be far right for a while until they crash out in the next election. If they lose, there's a fair chance that the party is going to move to a more inclusive, but still very conservative party, inclusive towards particularly Hispanics.
And before we move on to Europe, can I just ask a really obvious question? What are your predictions for the election? You talk about Biden needing a landslide. Do you think that's likely?
I don't really like much to make predictions, and I will only make the prediction that I want to lose. I see all the numbers and I see that Biden has to win this. But I really believe that voter suppression is going to be so massive that I still worry that Trump wins. I don't think we will know for weeks, probably a week to 2 weeks after the election day. Like we experienced this in Georgia in 2018 with the gubernatorial race, similar kind of issue, very close, endless debate back and forth. I expect the same. I was optimistic for a while, but if you look at the COVID effect on the Trump support, it's not particularly big, particularly how disastrous his handling has been. The country is getting tired of it. It wants to move on. And so I still have a bad feeling.
And before we move on to Europe, could I just throw in one last question on Trump? Recently, there's been quite a lot of attention on the QAnon conspiracy theory, which claims Trump is the last bastion of defense against an elite cabal breeding children for pedophilia. Why is conspiracy theory so important to the far right? It seems like once people believe in such an outlandish idea that you could never really convince them of another political stance. And I'm wondering how, there's obviously been lots of talk about it internationally as a phenomenon. I'm wondering how far you think it has spread amongst the Trump base.
Well, recent studies that were also reported in the Monkey Cage showed that actually QAnon is much less spread than you would now think because of the media. At the same time, certain aspects of it are spread among a third to more of the Republican base. Now, the question is, how new is that? If you look at all of the conspiracy theories that were going around about Obama being a secret Muslim during the Tea Party period about a decade ago, that was similar numbers. And in the 1990s, we had conspiracy theories about black helicopters and the UN going to invade the US, which again were spread very broadly. I mean, people like Pat Robertson, the evangelicals, who has a massive following, wrote about black helicopters in his books. Americans love conspiracy theories. Like, it was a national pastime to figure out who killed JFK. Liberals have massive conspiracy theories about what the Russians are all doing. Not to say that the Russians are not doing anything, but many of the theories of people are very, very popular on Twitter are pure conspiracy theories. There's no evidence for it. So in a polarized society, conspiracy theories are going to be through the roof for two reasons. First of all, because politics becomes very monist. It is between two blocks and the blocks are homogenous. And second of all, the distinction is moralist and the other part is evil. And so this is the core of populism, but it's also the core of anti-populism. And so we see conspiracy theories on both ends. Yes, they are more important within the far right and particularly within that subset of Republicans that are truly believers in Trump, so to say. But it has a very long history, right? And in that sense, I don't think that QAnon is necessarily so much different than what we have seen before. Like, we just now, because of social media, we see everything that's out there. Like, I mean, you wouldn't have wanted to have had Twitter in the 1960s.
Yeah, I guess not. I feel like there's a bit of smugness. Like, we look at America and think, well, things are definitely much darker there. But the far right is also on the march, not just in Hungary and Poland, but also in pockets of more kind of considered more centrist countries. Where do you see the main dangers in Europe?
Well, obviously, the main danger is and has been for almost a decade now, Hungary. And not because Hungary is particularly powerful, but because Hungary is a part of the EU, and the EU allegedly is a project of liberal democracy. And at the same time, it has at its heart not just an illiberal democracy, but for all purposes, a non-democratic regime. And that undermines pretty much all of the whole purpose of the European Union. But what you also see is that it's spreading. Like, it's spreading to Poland, which has spoken about following the Budapest model since they were in opposition in 2011. But it goes much further than that. HDZ in Croatia has very dubious relations to liberal democracy. Orban has been funding and supporting people like Janša in Slovenia, who is now back in power. Outside of the EU, in Macedonia, the VMRO. And so you see it spread, and you see that leaders who already don't have particularly strong democratic norms, they look at Hungary and see what Orban gets away with and learn the lesson that if by and large you vote loyally with the EPP in Brussels and you treat particularly German industries very well, then you can do almost whatever you want in your own country. And that is why Hungary is so problematic. It's problematic because it shows that for all the talk about liberal democracy, like, the EU in the end doesn't actually care that much if you behave in some other ways. And so for me, from the beginning, Hungary has been that important. And that's why I've all the time hammered on it. And I think it honestly has exposed the European Union. And they understand, they're very aware of it at the moment. But they kind of feel too weak, because of course it becomes harder and harder to punish Hungary when they have more and more people who will have their back. So yeah, outside of Hungary and to a certain extent Poland, and Poland is of course problematic, but I mean, to be very blunt, Kaczynski is just not as clever as Orban, and as a consequence can't get things through and faces more opposition. Outside of that, there are of course threats from the far right, but you do have to put things in perspective. In very few countries does the far right even approximate the type of power that Orban has or that Trump has.
And I think one of the differences in Poland also is that there is a far-right coalition in government, right? And you've seen that fractured recently. So law and justice have to preside over this quite pluralistic far-right coalition that creates some managerial challenges for them. And maybe it's just because Orban has been in power longer, I don't know, but he's managed to consolidate his hold much more strongly. I feel if Ursula von der Leyen was here, she might say, hang on a minute, we're doing our best or whatever. And while I fully agree with what you say, to play, I don't know, play devil's advocate here, do you think that the EU is kind of stuck in its rule-based order in some ways, that we know to have proceedings against a country for breaking with liberal democracy in the European system, you have to have universal support at the European Council. So all of the nation states have to agree that, hey, this country has gone too far and we're going to sanction them. In 2000, and you write about this in your recent book, it didn't exactly happen in this way, but basically the whole of the European Union at the time was united in saying Austria, the far right have entered power, there's going to be diplomatic sanctions. Today, in 2020, the far right is just too strong. It's everywhere. And the EU is unable to do that response. And constitutionally, when it looks at Hungary, it has this problem where Poland's always going to veto sanctions against Hungary. So there's nothing we can do. So the rule-based system that has been the heart of the liberal democratic European project then becomes this big problem in tackling the rise of the far right in different nation states, because the far right is too strong within this rules-based order.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree that it is, but even if that were to be the case, then obviously they have failed over the last decade. It took several years for PIS to come back to power. In those years, Hungary could and should have sanctioned at various cases. Hungary has by far the most corruption cases going against it. This is very well known. It's a kleptocracy. Almost all of the money that goes there, and the disproportionate amount of money goes from the EU to Hungary, ends up in the pockets of Orban and his cronies. They could have sanctioned that. You don't need anyone else for that. The commission could have sanctioned it. They could have withheld money. That would have put pressure on Orban. They didn't. And they didn't, not because they couldn't, because they didn't want to. And the connections, and there's a really good article in Direct 365, which is one of the last remaining independent online Hungarian websites. There's a really good investigation in the very long ties between Orban and German politicians, going back initially to the FDP, but then very close to Kohl, and then moving particularly to the CDU in Baden-Württemberg in the south, and to the CSU, as well as to the ÖVP in Austria. And this has all to do with business interests, and particularly the German car industry makes bank in Hungary, and Hungary provides almost Chinese conditions for them there. And those are choices. Those are choices being made by economic leaders and by the political leaders that protect them. It's also very clear that this, in the end, is all about the EPP. It's about the European People's Party. That's the reason why Poland can't get everything done, because they made the mistake to get out of the EPP and join the ECR, which is not particularly powerful. But one of the important things that you said is, well, the far right is everywhere. Indeed, they are everywhere, but not so much as in everywhere as in power. They're in every group almost. And so the European Parliament has this bizarre rule of a cordon sanitaire to prevent members of the Identity and Democracy group, the official far-right group, from getting senior positions, which is complete bollocks, of course, when like you have far-right people in the EPP. The whole ECR is by and large now a far-right group. And so if the mainstream like completely has accepted far-right parties and positions, then the rest becomes all posturing. And this is the lesson that smart, ambitious, not overly democratic politicians in particularly Central and Eastern Europe, but not only, have learned from the Hungarian perspective. And yeah, you can say, well, now it's too late. It's not too late, but now the costs are going to be much higher than they were before.
It's so interesting what you say about Germany, because they always manage to keep their noses so clean in any of these discussions. You know, they're always the kind of most stable of the core European group and the most law-abiding in terms of kind of their international obligations and as people. And typically, everybody thought of Italy as the risk factor under Salvini's Lega. But since the coalition between Five Star and the recent reform of the Eurozone, is Italy no longer considered a danger from a far-right point of view?
Well, Lega is still clearly the most popular party. On top of that, Brothers of Italy is growing as well. And so there's a very good chance still that after the next election, particularly given how selfish most EU states have responded to the COVID-19, and many Italians feel that they were mistreated, they didn't get the solidarity they had hoped for. So there's a fair chance that the far right will come back, and it will, of course, again be a right-wing coalition. But this time, Salvini and Meloni, the leader of Brothers of Italy, will be much stronger than like the Forza and Christian Democratic part of it. Now, the difference, of course, is that it will still be a coalition. And while they all dislike the other parties and they all dislike the EU, Meloni is not going to give full powers to Salvini. And Salvini is not going to give full powers to Meloni. And that is one of the reasons why quite often, even if you have a fully, for the sake of argument, populist coalition, it will not undermine the democratic system in the same way as a single party populist government, because there's this distrust towards each other and things are leaking. So I think that Italy remains a problem. And I think Italy is also just a very painful story, again, for the EU. Italy used to be one of the most pro-EU countries within the union and has become one of the most Eurosceptic countries. And I think for very good reasons. They were ignored both during the so-called refugee crisis, which was allegedly solved with the EU-Turkey deal, but then like Italy still had large numbers of asylum seekers coming in, but the EU didn't want to recognize that because they had all declared the so-called refugee crisis to be over. And now with COVID-19 again, and so Italy has kind of become the symbol of paid the brunt of the lack of European solidarity. And this has led to a massively Eurosceptic country, which is one of the original founders, of course. And I think this is something that the EU should reflect on much, much more.
And we knew this was going to be a depressing conversation at the outset, but bear with us, listeners, as we run through quickly Britain, of course. Now, Brexit has not been the great success story for the European far right that people like Marine Le Pen in France once hoped that it would be. Do you think that this has just changed the calculation of the far right towards the EU rather than really putting them on the back foot in the sense that no one really talks about leaving anymore, or not with the same enthusiasm as they did before?
Yeah, I mean, initially this clearly was the case. In 2017, you could see that very strongly. Parties that were arguing for an exit, and particularly Marine Le Pen, but even Salvini, they were walking it back a bit, and Le Pen said, well, we'll give the EU about half a year to respond to all the issues that we have, and then we'll organize a referendum. You see it in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders, who hasn't changed his mind. He just doesn't emphasize it anymore because it's just not particularly popular. And I believe that this will be the case for quite a few years more. But I think Simon Hicks once said this as well. In the longer run, Britain can become actually like the example of a successful exit. At the moment, it shows everyone that actually getting out of the EU is way more difficult than we ever thought. And so most countries, you see pro-European sentiments and parties stay out of it. And in the coming months, probably years, Britain will most likely suffer economically and there will be some chaos. But it's very likely that in 5 to 10 years, Britain will pretty much have recovered and will be doing fine. I mean, maybe not as good as under EU membership, but also not much worse. At that point in time, Britain will become an example for people who want to get out of the EU and will say, look, Britain is out of the EU, you can do it. Like as they now already say, Norway's out of the EU, you can do it. Switzerland's out of the EU, but Britain, of course, went out of the EU and is therefore more similar. Obviously, the big difference is that the UK was much less integrated into the EU as virtually any other country. And so the fact that even if it happens that Britain will be fine outside of the EU doesn't necessarily mean that the Netherlands or France could do it as well. But I think it is inevitable that Britain will transform from this kind of nightmare scenario to type of dream scenario.
Fascinating. And that's why we've got to fight it. That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. We know it hasn't been a super optimistic podcast, but the discussion isn't actually over. An extended version of this is available to members of Another Europe is Possible. In this week's extra time, we get to the optimism and we ask Cass what advice he gives to the political left in Europe and the United States on how to resist the far right and build coalitions for that transformative change. He has some straightforward do's and don'ts for the left. Most importantly, don't copy the far right. Very, very important tidbit of advice, and it's a great discussion. You can get access to that extra material by joining Another Europe is Possible, the home of the European left in Britain. To join, just go to anothereurope.org/join. We'll be back very soon. See you then. This is where we'll ask a couple of optimistic questions in the last 10 minutes we have before you have to go and do your teaching. So what advice would you have to the left on how to go about pushing the far right backwards? We've just heard that there's this possibility that Britain in the future could become a model right-wing populist state and all the dangers that entails. So clearly that's something that we in this country will do our best to resist. What would your do's and don'ts be when it comes to what the left should be doing in this situation?
Well, don't copy the right. I think that's the most important lesson. And we've seen that over and over and over again. Don't adopt Islamophobia or kind of like nativism light. It doesn't win you back voters. It doesn't make the issue go away. It gives it pretty much just even more received wisdom status, and it heightens expectations. And so I think more than anything, the fight is not against the far right. The fight is for liberal democracy, and the far right profits from a lack in belief in liberal democracy, in a lack of belief in multiculturalism, tolerance, in welfare states, in social distribution. And so I think it's very important for particularly social democrats to return to their core values and work from there. And social democrats have, like to a certain extent the center right, have not developed many ideas over the last decades. They still don't have, in any country that I know of, a social democratic vision on multiculturalism, for example. They have very little vision on European integration. And that is what is needed. I do believe in ideology. Now, obviously, you need to be consistent in your politics. You need to be open about what you do and why you do it. You just have to be realistic about the world in which you live. You are going to live with a European Union, whether you like it or not. Even if you like it, the European Union is not what you want it to be. So what are the consequences of that? right? Social Democrats across Europe, including in Britain, have really not been particularly open and honest about the problematic sides of the European Union, and I think have undersold the necessity of the European Union in developing even a national social democratic agenda. I also think it's important to stress the strength of liberal democracy and explain that liberal democracy is not just about majority rule. It is about protecting minorities, both individuals and political minorities. And so everyone can be a political minority at a certain point in time. That is the system that protects it. And we have to get back on the offensive. Like at the moment, most non-far-right actors respond. They respond to what the attacks of the far-right or what they think the far-right is going to do. Like the far-right does not represent the majority of the people. At best, they are a loud minority. And once you accept that, perhaps then it's easier to think again for yourself and try to set the agenda. That doesn't mean that you ignore issues that are so-called radical right issues, like immigration or European integration or crime or corruption, whatever. All of those things are important, but they're not more important than the environment, housing, education, etc. Right? So it's about setting an agenda again and having actually an ideological response to some of the core issues.
And finally, just to end on another positive note, we've seen Biden with the Green New Deal and numerous other things he said adopt a very Sanders-like approach, maybe if not at a granular level, certainly at a rhetorical level. Do you think that this is an object lesson in how the centre and the left can sort of cross-pollinate, or is it a bit more murky than that?
I feel a bit pressured here because you want to end on a positive note. And I don't necessarily see that. I think it was the Financial Times that recently had a piece on arguing pretty much that and an overview of the different people that were important advisors of Biden and of the different points that they were pushing for. Yes, it's true that because of this unity task forces between Biden and Sanders, a lot of people from the Sanders campaign or close to him are now active within the Biden campaign, as well as several points have been taken on. At the same time, if you look at who the real advisors are, the people closest to Biden, it's really just Obama 3.0. These are all people from the Obama administration. Most of them are very cautious, as the Obama administrations always were. And that's why I'm not overly optimistic. I was more optimistic a few months ago because I saw various people from the Sanders camp come in and I saw some statements about Biden having been really shocked by the impact of COVID. Yes, Biden will be more left-wing than Obama. That's just a sign of the times. But for Biden to be kind of the left-wing politician that he suggests he might be, the left will have to mobilize during his presidency, something that they forgot to do during the Obama presidency, because Biden and his advisors are centrist people who will listen to the center right, which mostly exists still in Wall Street, more than to the Sanders people. But if confronted with mobilization of the left in both the House of Representatives and the streets, I think there is more possible. But he has to be reminded of that over and over again. And that's how politics should be anyway. Like just because your camp is in power doesn't mean that you should stop being critical. You should be constructive, but you should nevertheless keep pushing. And so that's my hope really for if Biden would win, is that the left doesn't make the same mistake as they made under Obama and just fall flat pretty much and just expect Obama to naturally do what they believe in.
Fantastic. I think that was an optimistic note to end on.
I tried.
Yeah, and you know, these are tough times, but the left in the US should be organizing, you know, million-man marches under a Biden administration fighting for Green New Deal, increased corporation tax. I think that there's a difference as well in the United States about spending money just because of the role that the dollar plays. So there is now, especially after Trump, there's this consensus almost, I don't know if you agree, maybe this is a final cheeky question, there's a consensus almost that you can spend big, but the right and the Republican right want to spend big to do corporate welfare, but there's an opportunity for the left to spend big in a way that other countries in the world, yes, the role of the dollar makes it much easier in the US to spend big, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there are some people, they were particularly in the Sanders camp, who have always argued that, said that the US has this advantage in the sense for, let's say, Keynesian economics to invest massively at a time that the economy is contracting because it controls like the world currency. Again, Biden himself and the people around Biden come out of an administration, the Obama administration, that kind of felt that they paid the price for that. And of course, this is the horrible thing about US politics, that you have consistently now over decades a right that just wastes money left, right, and center, particularly on just corporate welfare, and massively increases budget deficits. And a left or like centrist Democrats who tend to be reasonably prudent. And yet, for your average American, the Democratic Party is associated with wasting money and spending just blindly. And the Republican Party is trusted as being prudent and being cautious with how to spend money. And of course, that is the reason why it's much harder for the Democratic Party to spend than for the Republican Party to spend. Even now, after the massive, massive new debt that Trump has created, the Republican Party is still trusted more in terms of economy and is still seen as pretty much like a prudent party. And so that will always be the problem for the Democrats.
Well, a third of our listeners aren't British, but for those listeners that are British, God, what you're saying about the Republicans being trusted is obviously identical to the political discourse in the UK around the Conservative Party. And the parallels are quite strong, although austerity was obviously a big Conservative project over the last decade. But thank you so much for coming on. It's been brilliant.
It was fascinating, yeah.
Thank you.
And keep in touch and good luck. We'll all be hoping, and even the atheists amongst us will be praying for the right result on the 3rd of November.
Yeah, me too.